This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Complete Book of Five Rings, written by Miyamoto Musashi, edited and translated by Kenji Tokitsu, narrated by Brian Nishi. Introduction. A legendary figure. In popular Japanese culture, Miyamoto Musashi is a legendary figure. This warrior of the 17th century, a master of the sword, but also a painter, sculptor, and calligrapher, left us a body of written work that has an important place in the history of the Japanese sword. His dense and brief Gorin no Sho, or Writings on the Five Elements, popularly known as the Book of Five Rings, is a summary of the art of the sword and a treatise on strategy. Although the painting, sculpture, and calligraphy of Musashi are less well known, they are considered by connoisseurs to be of the first order. Because of the extension of his art into so many domains and the way in which he explored the limits of the knowledge of his time, Miyamoto Musashi reminds us of Leonardo da Vinci. His personality and his adventurous life have been popularized by a famous novel and many films. Here, I present a completely new and annotated translation of the principal work of Miyamoto Musashi. Because of its concision, the Gorin no Sho is a hard text for contemporary Japanese people to understand. The misunderstandings can only be greater for Westerners, who might draw the impression from the apparent clarity of the text that they are understanding it, when in fact, the author's essential ideas are eluding them. For this reason, I have accompanied the text with clarifications, some of which are historic, others linguistic, and still others related to the nature of martial arts practice. I undertook this project even though several translations of the Gorin no Sho already exist. Through careful rereading the Japanese text, I discovered that these translations contained many errors or misunderstandings. Translation of this work is a difficult undertaking because of the considerable evolution the Japanese language has undergone since Musashi's time, but even more so because of the major problem connected with the role, at once limited and important, played by verbal explanation in the traditional martial arts. That which is expressed in words is a little like the knot in an obi. Only the knot is manifest, visible, but without the continuity of the belt, the whole thing would not hold together. What takes on meaning in the nodal point of the word is the entirety of a shared experience. The principal mode of transmission of the martial arts was direct teaching. Words played a small role, and writing was confined for the most part to a simple enumeration of technical terms. This approach did not stem from respect for tradition. Rather, it was connected with the very considerable difficulty of communicating techniques of the body and mind in writing. In the Scroll of Water, the second section of the Gorin no Sho, for example, when Musashi explains techniques in words, it is difficult to understand, since the execution of each technique takes only a few seconds. The description in writing of a movement of the body that lasts only a few seconds is very complex. I continually have this experience in my own work. Nevertheless, at certain moments in the course of a student's development, a single word can trigger a profound understanding of the art by creating a new order for the experiences accumulated in the silence of physical practice. Musashi's words have this objective. One of the big obstacles in translating the work of Musashi lies in this gap between his words and his body. I have attempted to bridge this gap through my own experience of Budo, for the Gorin no Sho is one of the books that serve me as a guide in the practice of the way of martial arts. The name and image of Musashi have been familiar to me from earliest childhood through stories, films, and later novels. Musashi reappeared for me in the form of the Gorin no Sho at a time when, After several years of practicing karate, I began to wonder about the relationship between this art and the tradition of the sword, which I saw as the essence of budo. It should be noted that from the cultural and ideological point of view, the tradition of karate is different in some respects from that of budo. Karate was a local practice transmitted secretly on the island of Okinawa in the extreme south of Japan, and it was not included in the framework of budo until around 1930. The degree of technical refinement and depth that had been reached by karate at that time was nowhere near that of the Japanese art of the sword. Nonetheless, it quickly emerged, after the presentation of karate to the Japanese public, that this art fit in well with the modern life of the 20th century and was capable of developing as a contemporary form of budo. For this discipline, newly a part of budo, the most important reference point was the Japanese art of the sword. By relying on this tradition, and particularly that of kendo and judo, karate found its budo form. Hence, for Japanese karate practitioners, writings on the art of the sword became the cultural and technical reference points for their art. As a result, the Gorin no Sho has been my companion for the last 25 of my 40-plus years of practicing budo. Of course, the intensity of my practice is not of the same order as Musashi's, but I have tried to bridge the gap between Musashi's words and the body through my own practice, however limited. The other difficulty encountering and translating the Gorin no Sho is more classical. How is it possible to bring out the proper sense of a word when the cultures involved are as different as those of the contemporary Western world and Japan of the 17th century? I will give you just one example. In this work, Musashi very frequently uses the term kokoro, which is customarily translated mind or heart. Many sentences, if translated literally, would yield expressions such as, "Your mind must be resolute, tight, calm," and so on. Since the English language makes much greater use of expressions in which the person takes on the role of the subject, the translation that seems to me to render these Japanese expressions the best is, "Be determined, tight, calm," and so on. The idea expressed in Japanese by kokoro is included in the English personal form of the subject. In English, when you say, "be calm," the underlying idea is that the mind should be calm, the primacy of the mind over the body being implicitly understood. In Japanese, this primacy is not assumed in the same way. Musashi wrote, "The mind should not be pulled about by the body. The body should not be pulled about by the mind." This way of distinguishing the mind and body was established within the context of a way of thinking and a language in which the prevailing tendency is to mix the mind and body together non-hierarchically, and in which an analytical effort has to be made to distinguish them. A superficial interpretation might see an affirmation of dualistic thinking in such remarks as Musashi's above, whereas, quite to the contrary, we find in such remarks efforts aimed at establishing distinctions that are not taken for granted. All through this work, proper names have been given in the order customary in Japan, that is, with the patronymic preceding the personal name. For warriors, one or several personal names or names linked to their function may be added. In this society of warriors, the system of names was more complicated than it is in the present day. Patronymics and personal names are variable, being determined by several factors. For example, Musashi, during different periods of his life and in different circumstances, was referred to by the following family names: Hirata, Takemura, Shinmen, Hirao, and Miyamoto. To his personal name, Musashi, which was then a common personal name, he attached a warrior suffix, sometimes Masana, sometimes Masanobu. In addition, When a warrior claimed connection by distant kinship with one of the great historical clans, he also put a reference to this in his name. In the Gorin no Sho, for example, Musashi refers to himself as Shinmen Musashi no Kami, Fujiwara no Genshin. Shinmen was the name of the lord of whom his family were vassals, and Fujiwara was the name of one of the most important clans starting in the 7th century. Finally, Genshin was the personal name chosen by him or his family to designate him within this clan. Genshin would be the Buddhist name for Musashi. To simplify these very long names, after the second appearance, I have designated a historical person by his personal name, since the personal name of a historical person was generally more specific and distinctive than his family name. Thus, I have used Musashi rather than Miyamoto, since the name Musashi, for the Japanese, calls to mind most of the time Miyamoto Musashi. But if you write Miyamoto, you are not necessarily referring to Miyamoto Musashi. Place names in Japanese include specifications such as village, island, or temple. I also preceded the names with these specifications in my translations, in spite of the redundancy, in order to make things easier for those who do not know Japanese. For dates, the number of the month has been kept, as in the Japanese system. In order to make the chronology clear for those who do not know Japanese, the years are given according to the Western system, despite the risk of some disparity. To be specific, the life of Musashi runs between the 12th year of the Tensho period, which corresponds on the whole to the year 1584, and the second year of the Shōho period, which in the same way corresponds to the year 1645. The strategy of combat, as well as reflection on it, constitutes the basic background of Musashi's life and conferred on it several dimensions. It was his constant reaching toward creating an expression of his art in writing that gives a unique quality to Musashi's work. In his youth, at around the age of 22, Musashi wrote a scroll entitled Writings on the Sword Technique of the Enmei-ryu, Enmei-ryu Kenbosho. Enmei-ryu was the first name Musashi used to designate his school. En means circle or perfection. Mei means light or clarity. Ryu means school. This image is derived from one of the techniques of the school, in which the practitioner holds his two swords in such a way as to call up the image of a circle. This work contains 22 instructions having to do exclusively with the art of the sword. The Gorin no Sho was preceded by other works that appear to function somewhat as sketches for it. In 1641, Musashi wrote the 35 Instructions on Strategy, Hyōhō Sanju Gokajō, a work written for Hosokawa Tadatoshi, the lord of Kumamoto on Kyushu, with whom Musashi stayed as a guest during the last period of his life. This scroll, composed of instructions on the art of the sword, is very similar to the Gorin no Sho. Finally, just before his death, Musashi composed another text, The Way to be Followed Alone, Dokkodo, in which he distills his final thoughts. Most of the time, the reflection provoked by the in-depth practice of a martial art is allowed to feed back into the practice itself without being exteriorized, except perhaps in the form of brief aphorisms. As a practitioner of Budo, I myself feel the difficulty of putting my experience into writing, as though, having immersed myself in water, I were immediately to try to turn the pages of a book without getting them wet. The work of Musashi stands out all the more because very few accomplished practitioners have written on the martial arts, especially during the period when the system of transmission was direct. This exceptional quality is borne out by the limited number of works on the art of the sword written during the 2.5 centuries of the Edo period, 1603 to 1867. The number appears very small in view of the large number of practitioners of the art. There are several reasons why so few texts have been written on the arts of combat. The difficulty of explaining the practice in words. Practitioners are generally content to progress on the way of practice without writing about it, since intensive practice requires a person to immerse himself fully and deeply in his actions. An objective written description is difficult, for it requires one to assume some distance from the practice. If the practitioner has recourse to language, it is usually selectively in order to bring out an intuition rather than pursue a line of logic. Moreover, studying the practice of an art of combat in depth is not always compatible with writing about this art, for the process of going into the practice deeply means acquiring a capacity for sensory motor reactivity that goes beyond the reach of mental reflection. Spontaneous movement and intuitive comprehension are reinforced, and one must avoid increasing the gap between perception and reaction by adding the pitfalls of intellectual speculation. Reflection is a part of Budo, but it must be self-directed, introspective reflection that is not allowed to intervene in the moment of combat, where the spontaneity of movement is essential. However, as Musashi wrote, combat is not confined to the moment when it is actually taking place. In Musashi's time, when confrontations were direct, it was enough for the majority of accomplished practitioners to immerse themselves deeply in their practice and limit themselves to a few words, just enough for quasi-subliminal hints intelligible to their students. In the transmission of a school's art, sometimes a language developed that was unintelligible to outsiders, based on a very broad intuitive register and seldom going in the direction of logical development. From that point of view, Musashi's work is exceptional. Nonetheless, looked at from our present point of view, his logic does not always seem coherent, and the meaning of his words is not always precise. If his words had been received directly from him in the flesh, with swords in hand, these verbal inexactitudes and ambiguities would not have been important, because Musashi's body and swords would easily have dispelled the ambiguities. However, 3.5 centuries now separate us. Someone who practices a martial art in depth and trains every day to the point of exhaustion has a tendency to develop a relationship with words that becomes prosaic or perfunctory at the same time as the intuitive aspect of his participation grows. He will tend to distance himself from long-winded objective reflection. He develops an intuition that can find a profound or manifold meaning in a single expression or a single ideogram. The sense of fullness that comes from these intensive physical exercises reduces the amplitude of logical sequences. It is only when the practitioner crosses the threshold of another dimension, where the sensation of fullness is realized through a stable treading of the way, that words will become more tangible. Thus, it is no surprise that Musashi wrote his major work just before his death, even though he had been trying to write since his youth. The major importance of the art of combat for Japanese warriors. During Musashi's time, the tradition of a period of war was reflected directly in the way warriors practiced the sword. In the time that followed, with the coming of social stability, the symbolic aspect of the art of combat progressively increased in importance, and the link between that art and a warrior's morality became more intimate. At the same time, the schools, now less involved in actual combat, became more dependent on feudal lords. These lords, to build up their prestige, emphasized the secrecy of the teachings of their schools. This secrecy might well have been compromised by the production of writings. The relationship between speech and action among Japanese warriors. The proverb, "Speech is silver, silence is gold," is found in both the West and Japan, but it is interpreted and experienced in very different ways. The Japanese interpret this phrase as placing absolute value on silence and expressing contempt for eloquence. But this does not suggest contempt for words. On the contrary, it stresses the importance placed on every word. A worthy warrior spoke little because he knew the importance of words. The word was conceived in terms of the role it might play in a possible chain of cause and effect, even if this were to remain virtual. Like a sword, a word can wound or kill. But as long as one does not touch the blade, the sword is no more than a smooth piece of metal. Someone who knows the qualities of a sword does not play with it, and someone who knows the nature of words does not play with them. Warriors attributed power and effective action to words, especially names. That is why the name of a technique was an important secret for someone seeking to understand the mind behind it. Anonymous transmission of a martial art did not exist, at least for warriors. For them, the simple knowledge of how to do something was limited and incomplete. The ultimate transmission was in the name. For this reason, the ultimate transmission of a school often took place through communication of the names of all the techniques, of which the practitioner had already, for the most part, attained mastery. One did not fully acquire the technique of a school until it had been named. Miyamoto Musashi, 1584-1645, a contemporary of René Descartes, 1596-1650, lived at a turning point in the history of Japan, at the end of the period of feudal wars, at the moment when Japanese society was beginning to stabilize. Musashi witnessed the advent of the new system of warrior values, which was to be characterized by progressive internalization. Through his thought on strategy, which is pervaded by the philosophy of the period, we gain access to one of the roots of the culture of the Edo period. The name of Miyamoto Musashi is known to Westerners through translations of the Gorin no Sho, and especially through the translation of the novel by Yoshikawa Eiji entitled Musashi. Yoshikawa's novel ends with the famous duel between Musashi and Kojiro at Ganryujima. Musashi was 29 at the time of this fight, which was the period of his youth concerning which we have the least imprecise documentation. The popularity Yoshikawa's image of Musashi has enjoyed over several generations shows that the novelist was able to distill in his character the ideal image of the samurai to which the Japanese people were attached. Miyamoto Musashi had been renowned in Japan for a long time, but Yoshikawa's novel made him famous on a popular level with the public as a whole. The author accentuated the introspective side of his personality. People sometimes say Yoshikawa Musashi to refer to the image that the Japanese public has of Miyamoto Musashi today. This novel was published as a serial in a daily paper from 1935 to 1939. It is, in a way, an expression of the position Yoshikawa took in the debate over Miyamoto Musashi's true qualities that was going on among Japanese writers at the beginning of the 1930s. Naoki, a famous writer of samurai novels, triggered the polemic by writing that Musashi did not achieve excellence in the sword until a few years before his death. His view is that in his youth, Musashi was no more than an expert in publicizing himself, and that his strength in the sword was not extraordinary. He takes as his proof Musashi's duel against Sasaki Kojiro, in which Musashi used a wooden sword so as to have a sword longer than Kojiro's. Moreover, he deliberately delayed the time of the fight in order to disconcert his adversary. Naoki adds that although, as Musashi himself wrote, he had had more than 60 duels during his lifetime, most of them were against little-known samurai. This viewpoint is not entirely devoid of truth, but it is primarily based on suppositions. Another writer attacked this position and defended Musashi's qualities. The debate grew, and Yoshikawa was drawn into the controversy. What was important about this debate is that it touched upon the way the Japanese cultural identity was being presented, a particularly sensitive issue at the moment when Japanese society was preparing for the Second World War. Since Yoshikawa's book appeared, numerous works have been published on Musashi in Japan. The historical documents concerning Musashi are fragmentary but relatively numerous. They are not rich enough to allow us to construct a precise image of his personality, but they are sufficient to provide food for the imagination. These documents taken together seem to be equivalent to a small fragment of some piece of Greek pottery on the basis of which we might imagine a jar or a vase. Although the image of Musashi is vague, the features that emerge are very potent, strong in odor and color. It is difficult to maintain neutrality in the face of such an image. Either you like it or you do not. It seems to me that it is essentially primal attitudes of this sort that form the main basis for the disparate positions in the assessments of Musashi and his work evinced by contemporary Japanese authors. The members of one group, for example, Ezaki, Shunpei, and Naoki, do not like or even detest the image they hold of Musashi. These writers consider him a cunning and accomplished practitioner, but a second-class figure in the history of the Japanese martial arts. Some go so far as to characterize him as a paranoiac. In their view, the Gorin no Sho is a rather mediocre work. A second group, for example, Shiba Ryotaro, Tobe Shinichiro, and Saotome Mitsugu, judges the work and martial art of Musashi positively, but separates it from their assessment of him personally. In the view of these writers, Musashi was doubtless a great and accomplished artist and practitioner of the martial arts, but his personality is considered unbalanced by some of them and unwholesome by others. They do not like Musashi, but they do appreciate the quality of his accomplishments. A third group, such as Fukuhara Josen, Imai Masayuki, Nakanishi Seizo, Terayama Danchu, Morita Monjuro, and Naramoto Tatsuya, assesses both the accomplishments and the personality of Musashi positively. These writers consider his art, both martial and fine, as an overall reflection of his personality. The majority of works on Musashi belong to this category, and in many cases display no critical distance. A fourth group, for example, Takayanagi Mitsutoshi and Watanabe Ichiro, somewhat steps back from its personal appreciation of Musashi. These writers situate his works within their historical period and appreciate them particularly for their originality. Their attitude seems to be the most scientific, but in their method, they do not go beyond brief commentaries on the texts. Thus, for Takayanagi, the Gorin no Sho is difficult to understand mainly because of the lack of organization in Musashi's writing. But despite this defect, Musashi's work is admirable when one takes into account the shortcomings of his time, in which the distinction between religion and science was not sufficiently developed. Though it is perhaps still possible to criticize the swordsmanship of Musashi, since it belongs to the past, by contrast, his calligraphies, ink paintings, and sculptures have come down to us. Their artistic quality is undeniable, and they are well known in the history of Japanese art. True, the Gorin no Sho is difficult to understand, but its style appears relatively clear when compared with the works of Musashi's contemporaries. And as far as the content is concerned, only a great adept of the sword could have written it. As Musashi wrote, "Because I apply the principle of the sword to the other arts, I no longer have a need for a teacher in these other domains." The quality of his work, taken overall, indicates that he could only have excelled in the art of the sword. My way of presenting Musashi takes historical research as its point of departure, but is somewhat different from the approach of the historians, because I interpret the texts on the basis of my experience in the martial arts and attempt to derive from them teachings applicable to martial arts practice. How can we assess Musashi's practice of the sword? During this period, confrontations with the sword between practitioners of different schools, in most cases, meant death for one of the participants. The decision to make or accept a challenge demanded the utmost prudence. Mere bravado was not enough to survive a duel to the death. One had to have a level of accomplishment that was equal to that of the adversary. Now, it is undeniable that Musashi never made a mistake in accurately assessing the strength of an adversary. This made it possible for him to avoid fighting an enemy capable of defeating him. The word mikiri became the established term for characterizing this particular acuity of Musashi's perception. The origination of this term is attributed to him, but I have been unable to find it in his writings. The literal translation is mi, look, or see, and kiri, cut. This means to see with cutting minuteness, or to cut through with a look, which amounts to discerning the state of situations or things with incisive precision. In my view, this precise discernment characterizes the sword of Musashi as well as his aesthetic expressions. If he judged his adversary as potentially his superior, he avoided fighting him. Discernment of incisive precision was, for Musashi, the basis of individual and collective strategy. Mikiri distills in one word one of the teachings of Sun Tzu. If you know yourself and you know your enemy, you will not lose one fight in 100. For Musashi, just being strong individually was not of such great value, because he knew that the strength of a single person is limited and even insignificant in the unfolding of a large battle, such as those he participated in several times in the course of his life. He would have preferred to apply his talent fully on a larger scale, because he felt he had discovered a principle applicable to all phenomena of life. From the end of his adolescence, Musashi began to travel and engage in many duels. The age of 30 marked a change in his life. He continued to travel in order to deepen his art of swordsmanship, but he no longer sought out duels as he had before. At the same time, he was looking for a feudal lord who would entrust him with the elaboration of large-scale strategies. However, Musashi's rigor and precision sometimes made as disquieting an impression as the blade of his sword. This is something that can also be seen in his works of art. This is without doubt one of the reasons he was not able to obtain the position he was looking for with one of the great feudal lords. I am convinced that Musashi was a very great master of the sword, but I also think that several masters in the history of Japanese swordsmanship attained a level that was equivalent or superior to his. To reach an accurate evaluation of Musashi's martial art and personality, it seems indispensable to situate them within the history of the art of the sword in Japan. This is because, and Musashi's work is an expression of this, his period was the time at which the art of the sword began to pass beyond the sphere of military technique and merge with the practical notion of the way. The art of the sword was on its way to becoming, both technically and morally, a formative element in the life of the Japanese warrior. In accordance with the custom of the time, in referring to himself, Musashi used the term bushi, warrior, which means practitioner of arms. This was a reference to the division of Japanese society into four hierarchical social classes: warrior, peasant, artisan, and merchant, which the Tokugawa government had already firmly institutionalized by Musashi's time. By using the word bushi, warriors indicated their place in this hierarchy. This term appeared in the Nara period, 8th century and progressively supplanted the older term mononofu, signifying men who knew how to use weapons and were courageous. Samurai comes from saburai, the substantive form of the verb saburau, which means to serve or to remain at the side of someone important, and was itself an evolved form of the older samurau. Starting with the Heian period, 794 to 1145, samurai designated warriors who were in the service of nobles. Little by little, it came to be used by members of the other classes to refer to warriors in general. However, within the warrior class itself, it was used to refer to those most highly placed in the hierarchy. For example, the townspeople might call anybody who wore the two swords a samurai, but among warriors, this term was not applied to those who occupied the lower levels of the hierarchy. The power of the warriors became further established during the Heian period, especially starting with the 10th century, when the power of the government weakened in the provinces. The powerful gozoku, regional authority families, began to fight to protect and increase the territory they had acquired. They developed their military capability so they could govern the local peasants by themselves and protect themselves against rival powers, as well as the representatives of the state. They built themselves up into larger groups, united by ties of blood, and also, for those who succeeded in becoming part of it, by a strong consciousness of belonging to the group. These armed groups, called bushidan, developed in the provinces. Their moral values were based largely on the cult of ancestors and on family relations, which were expanded to form a clan hierarchy, as well as on values arising from the personal valor of combatants. The warrior art, to which warriors at first attached their identity, was archery. Yumiya torumi, literally, he who knows how to shoot a bow, designated men of war during the Kamakura period. Yumi no ie, designated a family that excelled in the art of archery and thus a family of warriors. Such warriors fought from horseback, mainly with the bow. When the use of the sword on horseback spread, it brought about a modification in swords, which began to take on a curved form. The mode of combat changed progressively, and in the 14th and 15th centuries, the sword assumed first place among the arts of the warriors and became their emblematic weapon. However, it would be inaccurate to think that the Japanese art of the sword developed in isolation, because the metallurgy connected with it came from China via Korea, and in the wake of this, interaction with these countries increased further. During Musashi's time, the art of the sword was dominant, and there were numerous schools teaching sword technique. Thus, in order to gain a clear understanding of the life of Musashi, who founded a school of swordsmanship, several branches of which still exist today, it seems essential to situate him within the history of Japanese schools of the sword. The main periods in the history of Japanese schools of swordsmanship. The formative period, 15th to 16th centuries. A decisive period in the formation and evolution of the way of the sword extends from the end of the 14th century to the beginning of the 17th century. Later, this period was to become a point of reference for masters and practitioners of the sword. Of course, the art of the sword in Japan is much more ancient than this. In the course of the 10th century, the shape of swords was modified, and the curved sword gradually replaced the straight sword. These changes were a reflection of a development of techniques in which the action of slashing became increasingly important. The elevation of the social status of warriors went hand in hand with the evolution of combat techniques. By the 11th century, the change in the form and technique of the Japanese sword was becoming widespread. Before this, the military force was overwhelmingly composed of foot soldiers who used the straight sword, mainly for stabbing. with the development of local military groups whose large estates permitted them to keep horses, mounted warriors assumed the primary place. The technique and form of the sword transformed little by little to facilitate the combat of fighters on horseback, for whom slashing is easier than stabbing. Curvature of the sword became important. The curved sword gradually came to be dominant, and slashing techniques were extended to combat on foot. The curved form of the sword stabilized beginning in the 12th century, and the name Nihonto, Japanese sword, was used to differentiate this curved sword from the straight sword, which preserved direct Chinese influence. The increase in the number of swords forged shows the dominance the sword was assuming, especially in the period from the 12th through the 14th centuries. The Nihonto, Japanese swords, made during the 6 centuries from the end of the 10th to the beginning of the 17th, the Keicho era, are classified as ancient swords and called koto. They are of a high quality that has not been equaled since. We know the names of more than 5,500 master smiths of ancient swords. According to Mitsuhashi Shuzo, there were 450 swordsmiths from the 10th century to 12th centuries, Heian period. 1,550 swordsmiths from the 13th to the middle of the 14th century, Kamakura period. 3,550 swordsmiths from the middle of the 14th to the end of the 16th century. In tandem with the evolution of the form of the sword, there was a remarkable surge in the development of sword technique. However, dependable documents on schools of swordsmanship do not go back beyond the end of the 14th century. Despite the fact that most schools like to claim that their roots go back to the Kamakura period, 1185 to 1333, or still further back, the lineages of the main traditional schools of the sword can be traced with certainty only back to the middle of the 15th century. From the last third of the 15th century until the end of the 16th, Japan was the scene of continual warfare among the feudal lords. It was through experience on the battlefield that the sword masters of that period developed their sword technique as well as their basic attitudes towards swordsmanship. The techniques of that period were relatively simple but forceful, since armor was worn in battle. Combatants used existing techniques, but also carried on their own personal search for more effective ones, based on their own experience. While continuing to accept the idea that the true ability to fight comes from actual battlefield experience, some warriors began to attach importance to training, to daily preparation for combat. This included matches that often took place without armor, which resulted in the development of greater subtlety and technique. The practice exercises called kumitachi or tachiuchi consisted in reproducing combat techniques derived from the experience of various masters. These exercises, in which either a real or a wooden sword was used, became standardized. Miyamoto Musashi lived at the end of this formative period of the classical schools of swordsmanship. Period of further development, 17th and 18th centuries. According to my analysis, we can consider the 17th and 18th centuries as the birth period of Budo. This period, in which the art of the sword was developed further, extends from the second half of the 17th century to the beginning of the 19th century. The shoguns of the Tokugawa family established and stabilized their power over the whole of Japan between 1600 and 1640. They imposed a strong rule that brought about a long period of peace, which lasted until the middle of the 19th century. This meant that warriors had to adjust progressively to a peacetime role. At the time of the feudal wars, one could have summed up the value of a warrior's swordsmanship by answering the following questions. How many heads can he cut off? In time of peace, This simple pragmatism transformed into an effort directed toward advancement in swordsmanship as an art. Since the way of action was closed to them, the swordmasters internalized their art. It became a quest for the way, Do. The level of commitment to this quest was deepened by the fact that the way, Do, derived a part of its meaning from the relationship between the lord and his vassals. The objective for the practitioner became finding a means to make progress in the way of the sword without really killing his adversary. From this point on, swordsmen no longer used armor, and sword technique was modified because there was no need for the forceful techniques that made it possible to kill an enemy through his armor. Masters developed subtle techniques that took into account the freedom of movement made possible by town clothes. The art of the sword reached its apex toward the end of this period. In the middle of the 18th century, certain schools began to train with the shinai, bamboo sword, and to use armor again. These developments became general by the end of the 18th century. These safety measures were conducive to unlimited matches between practitioners, and this encouraged the elaboration of technique within each school. Autonomous trends within schools multiplied. At this point, we can enumerate as many as 700 schools of the sword. As the art of the sword became increasingly refined, it became a major vehicle for the energy of warriors within a Japanese society that was becoming closed toward the outside world. Warriors heightened their art while almost never using it in real confrontations. They killed each other every day in practice, but in reality they avoided death. Nevertheless, the idea that combat to the death could become an actuality at any moment remained the basic reference point for the warrior's state of mind. At the same time, through the elaboration of technique, the idea of harmony began to infiltrate deeper and deeper into the basic antagonism inherent in the use of weapons. The art of the warriors flourished under a variety of names: bujutsu, bugei, kenjutsu, gekiken, tojutsu, kenpo. In all these disciplines, the energy of antagonistic confrontation remained dominant, symbolized by the wearing of the warrior's sword. The sword that accompanied a warrior everywhere still represented the fundamental idea of kill or be killed. The flowering of the art of the sword, 19th century. The third period of the history of schools of the sword encompasses most of the 19th century. The art of the sword flowered at the time when its power became a major factor in putting an end to the feudal period, which had been the period of the sword's dominance. At the beginning of the 19th century, swordsmanship passed through a brief period of decadence, for as the period of wars became more remote, the sword became disassociated from the reality of combat, and the position of warriors became uncertain. But then, quickly, the threat represented by Westerners provided warriors with a renewed consciousness of their role. In the course of the second half of the century, Japan passed through a succession of troubles connected with the threat of invasion by Western powers. This was the time when the Japanese began to become aware of the power of the Westerners and to look for the most effective means of opposing them. This attitude and a new awareness of society as a whole was reflected in the manner in which warriors practiced swordsmanship. The art of the sword had reached a high point during the preceding period, but in becoming disassociated from the reality of combat, it entered a decadent phase. The conflicts that pervaded Japanese society produced new needs, and the art of the sword then reached a level of fruition in which it produced sparks of steel between the two parties into which warriors were now divided, one defending the shogunate, the other seeking to oust the system of government. The reign of the shoguns came to an end in 1867, and the new regime, as part of its plan to set up a modern military and industrial power, abolish the privileges of the warriors. In spite of these difficulties, some of those who had survived the confrontations of the period of transition continued the tradition and practice of the sword. They had to put up with the prohibition against carrying a sword and come to grips with the then prevailing tendency to discredit traditional culture, which was the support of their identity. The sword of the warrior disappeared at the end of the 19th century with the death of those who had lived through the last period of actual sword combat. The notion of budo was born at the moment in which the class of warriors disappeared and the values of feudal society began to dissolve into the depths of modern society. Even though budo takes tradition as its basis, it is a modern notion. It defines a practice that takes shape around a kind of dilemma. Arms are fundamentally offensive, but budo's striving for quality in the art of arms contains within it an impulse directed toward the evolution of human beings as such,